Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local, innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, our conversations migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where I've already weighed in on today's topic. And you can also download podcasts of the best of Philosophy Talk and listen to us anytime, anywhere. And that's the truth.
That's the truth. And our topic today is truth, in particular, the value of truth. So, Ken, what's so valuable about truth?
It's obvious, John, that truth is valuable. Truth is worth knowing, worth telling, worth searching for. What could be more worthwhile than truth?
Well, you must be right that the value of truth is obvious because we have all these bromides. The truth shall set you free. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Truth is beauty and beauty truth. As philosophers, it's our job to instill in students the idea of follow the argument wherever it goes. Know the truth no matter how uncomfortable. But if we're going to do that and be true to our motto, question everything, we have to say, why? What's so great about truth?
Well, wait a minute. What's so bad about truth? I'm going to put the burden on you. Sounds like you're a bit skeptical about the value of truth, or at least thinks it's not necessarily obvious. Convince me that truth isn't or might not be valuable.
Well, I mean, lots of things are valuable, but you don't just say they're valuable eo ipso per se intrinsically. I mean, some bacteria are valuable and some aren't. Right?
Okay.
And aren't truths like that?
Okay,
I mean, some truths are valuable and some aren't.
Okay, you want an argument. I'll give you an argument. Okay, look, you want a cup of coffee, and you're here in the studio, and I tell you, there's coffee in the kitchen, right? And you believe that. If your belief is true, and you act on it, if you go to the kitchen believing there's coffee in the kitchen, you'll get what you want. So having true beliefs enables you to act in ways that satisfies your desire. So what could be more valuable than believing the truth?
Well, sometimes it's valuable not to believe the truth. Suppose a kid wants some drugs, and the truth is he can get drugs at the corner market by talking to the big shaggy guy and saying, "Where's Tina?" or something like that. Is it good for him to know the truth? No. It's going to ruin his life. Some truths are worth knowing. Some you're better off not to know, just like bacteria.
But you're confused, John. There's a desire not worth having, not worth pursuing. Right. But if that desire were worth pursuing, then knowing the truth would enable you to get what you want. Some desires you shouldn't have. That's true. So I don't think your kid should desire drugs. So that's true. You're confused.
Well, yeah. The truth is valuable if you have valuable desires. But, you know, not all truths are relevant. I mean, take for example, some truths are trivial. I mean, who cares that the last two fives on this piece of paper don't look exactly the same? Yet that's true. Some truths are large, but just depressing and of no use whatsoever to know, like the fact that the universe is a meaningless pile of bleep.
Ooh, you're depressing me. So look, you said, okay, I got you now. I think I got you. You said it can't just be truth because some truths are just irrelevant or trivial and aren't worth bothering about. And some truths are so too depressing to know. Just too depressing to know. So it sounds like you might rather believe an uplifting falsehood than a depressing truth. Is it? I mean,
well, I might or I might not. I mean, I like lots of things that aren't good for me. I like fat. I like things that are laden with cholesterol. I like sweets. Those aren't good for me, but I'll pursue them. I've been raised to love the truth. But maybe sometimes when I pursue the truth, it's not really good for me.
Yeah, you might be right. But, you know, the problem is that if you believe something, you believe it's true, right? And so just in believing something, you're already committed to its being true. So you can't really separate truth from our beliefs. It's kind of like intrinsically tied up with the very enterprise of believing.
Well,
say this. It's false, but I believe it.
Well, it's true. I'll give you that. Once you're involved in investigating something, if you believe it's true, you believe it. But in our long-range plans, we decide, I'm going to really investigate my beliefs about this. I'm really going to invest my beliefs about that. You know, is it really important to me to decide whether the Lindbergh kidnapping was fairly adjudicated or whether Bruno Hauptmann was innocent? I could decide to pursue that. Once I get into it, what looks true, I'll believe. But is it a good idea? Does it make any point? Does it matter to my life? Will it be useful to me in any way to know the truth about that? Well, I doubt it.
Those are good questions. And you know what? Our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, went out on the streets and found some people and put those kinds of questions to them. She files this report.
The science fiction show The X-Files said the truth is out there. Maybe so. But is telling the truth always the way to go?
I used to know this guy who was always saying there is not a dichotomy between truth and falsehood. Now, I think he took that philosophy too far. We were discussing whether or not women who are past their prime might lie about their age, and he says, well, I think that women lie about their age to an extent. Now, if it's something like your age, that's pretty concrete. It's true or it's false. That's sort of like saying that someone's a little bit pregnant. He's right to a degree. If you tell your version of something that happened, well, you tell it from your own viewpoint, and you may honestly think that you're being truthful, but you put it in your own context. What's the whole truth?
Sometimes if you tell the truth and it hurts somebody or hurts your family, then you shouldn't do it. When Clinton had his affair, I could understand why he didn't tell the truth, because you don't want to be with your wife for the rest of your life. You know, it's pretty rough.
Yeah, I think the truth is the ultimate goal. I do. When someone says, I will love you forever, they're lying. Why are they lying? How are they lying? Is it even important to express or discuss or explore? Or do you just smile and take it as a compliment? Truth is relative. You know, there are universal truths, but that's only because we all agree. They may not necessarily be true. If we all agree, then that's true for us. But say what's true for me may not be true for you. So I say, I hate red. And you say, I love red. That's my favorite color. How could you ever say that about red? Don't ever talk to me again.
Well, I wouldn't say there's different kinds of truth. There's different levels to the truth or different aspects of it for a person that's in their dying hours. If their beliefs aren't the same as yours, then there are some things you really just wouldn't tell them. A lot of times, some things is best left unsaid. Not withholding the truth, just that it's not time for them to know it yet. Everything is in its season.
I think everybody's truth is different, and that is the problem of why we have such an imbalance in the world, because we all have our own perspective, and of course that is something to be expected. But it seems like the middle ground and, you know, being compassionate and open towards other people's truth and understanding that your truth isn't the ultimate truth. It's just what your mind and your heart is doing and your education and your exposure to what life is. But truth is variable.
I like the truth. I mean, I don't care if it hurts, but there have been times it's been difficult for me to face the facts. But before I could do any constructive thing, I have to be able to face the truth. It was a rude awakening when I was told I was a sinner. I am a conservative, and in San Francisco, I have to be culturally and socially sensitive. So these are times that sometimes I live a lie because I do not want to hurt the community I live in. So that's, if you want to know the instance is that I voted for Bush.
Do you really want to know? Do you really want to know?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly. That was Enya's version of the theme from The X-Files, underlying Polly's last comments. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry, and with me, according to my truth of things, is Ken Taylor.
No, I'm really here, John, and really joining us today is Simon Blackburn. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Cambridge. He's the author of Truth, a Guide, a book particularly relevant to our topic today. Simon, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, Ken. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Hello, Simon. John Perry here. Good to talk
Hello,
to you
John.
Again.
Good to hear you again, John.
So before we can determine the value of truth, maybe we should think a little bit about the nature of truth. Now, according to the Bible, Pontius Pilate asked, what is truth, and then took a hike. Well, I'm going to ask you what is truth, but I'm going to stay around and hear your answer. So what is truth, Simon?
In 30 seconds or less.
30 seconds or less.
Well, you wrote the book. I mean,
a very good answer is you tell me what the question is. So if you tell me the question is whether the price of gas is whatever it is, $2 a gallon, then the truth consists in the price of gas being $2 a gallon. If the question is whether Lindbergh was killed by somebody, X, then the truth is he was killed by somebody X. So it varies from question to question, and there's no general answer. Now, that's a theory called deflationism or minimalism in our trade, and it's rather surprising because it suggests there's actually nothing to say about truth. And, of course, I'm rather rare, I suppose, in having written a book about something which is largely concerned with the question of what there is to say about it.
So do you think that's the right view of truth? There are kind of particular truths. John Perry is in the studio. Ken Taylor is in the studio.
Yep.
And there's no kind of property truth that those things share that we can say anything informative about. You think that's the right view?
Well, my books are kind of wrestling with that view. I think it's a view worth putting on the table. And it's a very interesting view. I was interested hearing your interviews then, some wonderful comments, that people naturally gravitated towards the difficult cases, you know, moral cases, judgments of taste, judgments perhaps of religion. What's true for you isn't necessarily what's true for me. Nobody talks about the price of gas or which way to get to Main Street. But those are things about which there's a truth.
Well, there is a truth about the price of gas, and it's been a while since you've been over here, because it's almost $3 a gallon now.
But that's still cheap by poor, British standards.
Yeah, poor Americans are suffering so that the rest of the world can have petroleum.
But, Simon, one of the theory of truth that I think I first believed, I don't know if I still believe it, but the theory of truth I first believed when I started having beliefs about these things is the correspondence, you know? To say that snow is white is true is to say, well, there's a fact that snow is white, and the sentence or statement corresponds to that fact.
Well, you know, Ken and Simon, I feel a little bit like the guy that admitted he voted for Bush, because I still believe in the correspondence theory of truth.
Oh, no, John.
why not the correspondence theory of truth?
Well, the classic objection is that you can't stand on your own shoulder. You can judge the facts as best you see them, but then if you ask whether your judgment is true, there's no kind of scooting around the back or jumping up on your own shoulders and saying, oh, yeah, they're the facts, and there was my judgment. Wow, I got it right.
But that's not a complaint about what the theory of correspondence. That's a complaint about how we go about determining whether our judgments correspond to the world. We make another judgment, but why is that a
problem? Doesn't that disappear when you ask how you judge whether somebody else's views are true? You try to figure out what their views are, you check out the facts, and you see if they correspond. What's wrong with that?
That's right. You make your own judgment, and then your verdict will depend on the agreement or coherence between your judgment and theirs. And there lies the rub, because classically people started off with correspondence, and then they got involved in this kind of problem. They said, well, maybe there's nothing to truth except a great big uniform picture, a picture that works for us.
But let me give you a really quick 30-second defense of the correspondence theory of truth. It's the theory that makes the value of truth evident. It makes it clear why truth should be worth pursuing, because if we settle on the truth, our judgments are corresponding to how things are in the world, really. Mm-hmm. And achieving that relationship, having your judgments match reality, that's why truth is worth pursuing.
It's a lovely theory, and I actually believe, I'm conservative too, I believe there's something right about it, but it's a very difficult thing to say what it is in face of the onslaughts it's got from the people I just mentioned called deflationists, or the other people called coherentists, or some people called pragmatists who say, well, look, when push comes to shove, you know, if you ask why you think science gets things right, it's not because you've got a superior concept of correspondence to the facts. It's because it makes telephones, it makes radios, it makes iPods. It's useful. Yeah. And so the proof of the pudding's in the eating. Now, that's a very American and British view. And we like utility. We like things that work.
Although you don't mean the same thing by pudding that we do also.
Well, there is that.
Maybe some kind of deep divide
with
there.
With that ambiguity, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the value of truth. Our guest is Simon Blackburn, noted philosopher from Cambridge University.
Bandau Ballet and True. This is KALW, where you can actually hear the ballet. What other station can bring you the ballet on radio? This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. I think you're a little confused here. Today we're discussing the value of truth. Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And even while you're listening, you can still call into that pledge line.
And you can also email us. Just put as the address comments@philosophytalk.org. You can make it even simpler. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and hit the comments button, not any of the other buttons, and send us your email. Is truth intrinsically valuable? Are all truths worth knowing? Are there some truths we're better off not knowing?
Our guest is Professor Simon Blackburn from the University of Cambridge, author of Truth, A Guide. So, Simon, in some circles, truth has gotten a bad rap in sort of what people call POMO circles. Right?
Yep. POMO being short for postmodern.
Yeah, why is that? What's the rap? Now, I'm wondering if that rap is just against the correspondence theory of truth, or would our POMO friends like one of these other theories of truth better?
It's difficult to speak for all about all POMOs in one fell swoop, because often it's quite hard to understand what they're after at all. And I wouldn't like to say they're all after the same thing. But the general drift, I think, derives from, for example, Nietzsche, and back beyond him to Protagoras, one of Plato's great enemies. And the idea is that the trail of the human serpent lies over everything. So basically, you're always a victim of forces. In my book, I quote the Queen. The Queen is supposed to have said, our Queen, you know, God bless her.
Certainly not our Queen.
No, well, that was your loss back then. she's supposed to have said, apropos of the death of Princess Diana, there are dark forces at work of which we know nothing. And the idea is that our judgments are formed and shaped by economic forces, social forces, political forces, emotional forces about which we know nothing. And therefore, we're kind of victims. We're not in control of our judgments. We're, as it were, programmed to judge stuff in ways and to form beliefs in ways which probably have nothing to do with the way of the world.
If you were interested in truth, making your beliefs converged on the truth, you'd need some mechanism that regulated your beliefs that would guarantee somehow that they converged on the truth. And philosophy probably dreamed that it had such mechanisms. But the postmodern realization is, look, there aren't any mechanisms that reliably track the truth. The thing that govern our belief are tradition, culture, prejudice, all kinds of stuff. And why think that that tracks the truth?
That's exactly it. That's the dark forces. Now, in the old days, that used to issue in skepticism, which is slightly different. It just said, by God, there's a truth out there, but we'll never know it. In the POMO world, it issues in, hey, there's no truth out there. There's just the endless flow of opinion.
Yeah.
So let's go with the flow. Let's just say what sounds exciting.
it seems a rational reaction would be, well, there is a truth out there. And amazingly enough, given all of this, we occasionally stumble on it, which is shown by the fact that people land on the moon and a few things like that.
Wait a minute. Well, I don't know. I don't speak for the postmodernists. I don't quite see why that's a rational reaction, because where does the belief that there's a truth out there come from? Sometimes our beliefs converge with our fellow believers, right? But why should we take the convergence of our beliefs with our fellow believers as any more than, well, there's convergence with our fellow believers?
Well, before we turn it over to our expert, let me put in my two cents. Let's go back to Simon's distinction earlier. There's the correspondence theory of truth, the coherence theory of truth, the pragmatic theory of truth. Seems to me that if you're thinking about the truth in terms of other people, the correspondence theory is clearly the right way to go. You've got, in other words, in my picture of the world, there are these utterances, these books, and there's things that aren't utterances and books and thoughts. And I call the first ones true if they correspond to the second ones. And that seems to me to provide me a very good explanation about why these utterances lead to useful action and rockets landing on the moons and other ones don't, the false ones. Now, when you turn on me and say, how about my own beliefs? Well, maybe there's a problem there. Maybe I have to be a coherentist with regard to my own beliefs. All the only way I can check them is to see if they cohere. But I still say correspondence is a damn good theory.
What do you think, Simon?
Well, I love it, John, and I half agree with you. I think the problem is correspondence is great when you've got a simple representation model, like the gas gauge representing the amount of gas left in your tank, because we know how the thing varies, you know, the position the pointers go, or whatever it is these days, is going to vary with the amount of gas in the tank, and it's a wonderful representation device. But there are cases where we're not so sure. I mean, the obvious cases are morals, aesthetics, politics, where we're talking about, we're concerned very deeply about the truth of principles, strategies, beauty, where it lies, and so on. And we've got absolutely no conception of the way our petrol gauge works. Sorry, gas gauge. So then there's a problem about bringing the correspondence theory to bear, even.
Well,
those are the areas where I think people really get, hot under the collar about truth.
It's true that the correspondence theory has a consequence that there either are a lot more facts out there for the true things to correspond to in morals and all of that, or there are a lot less true things out there because there's a lot of things we call true that to which there are no facts to correspond. I favor more or less the second view, but maybe we should turn it over to Ken to see if we got a caller that can straighten us out.
I know a truth. You can join this conversation by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And on any theory of truth, that still works, whether you're a pragmatist, a coherentist, or whatever. And somebody's done that, Paul. Well, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Paul in San Francisco.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and welcome to Professor Blackburn. It's great
Thank
to have
you
on the show. Okay, I have a comment and then a question for you guys. And I'd like to get back to this issue of the value and significance of truth. And it seems to me that truth is universally significant and valuable when we're talking about knowledge and knowledge claims. And what do I mean by this? Well, for example, you know, when the president claims that he knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, he's claiming at the very least that it's true that Iraq has WMDs.
Right.
And if Iraq does not have WMDs, then it seems to me the president cannot rightly be said to know that Iraq has WMDs. Mm-hmm. And I defy anyone to give a counterexample to this relation between truth and knowing that something is true. So here it seems to me truth is indisputably significant and valuable, and we have knowledge if and only if we have truth. Now, we can call this relation between a true claim on one hand and reality on the other hand correspondence. And if that's what correspondence is, you know, what's the problem with it? And that's my question for you guys.
Thanks, Paul. Simon, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a nice example, Paul, and I don't know whether you do philosophy, but it sounds to me as though you've got the gene in your bones.
Yeah, so Paul's a philosopher. He's a friend of ours. Yeah.
Okay.
Paul, just listening between the lines there, are you implying ever so gently that going to Iraq was a stupid idea because it was based on falsehood?
Perhaps.
I see.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Never thought of that. I'll have
to take that. at least this, what we were talking about in the top of the show, because we operated on beliefs that were false, we didn't get what we wanted, right? Yeah. I mean, the falsity of our beliefs systematically interfered with the success of our actions.
Well,
anyway, I want to turn to Simon. tell me what you think.
Bush was reelected.
I agree. Well, it's nice that we focus on a particular issue because that, of course, is what the minimalist says we should do. Sure, you know, what's the truth about Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction? Well, it's true that he had them, or the sentence that he had them is true if and only if he had them. And that's, I think, common ground to everyone. So that's, if that's correspondence, we're all correspondence theorists. The problem is that you're not standing on your own shoulder. You're not, as it were, it's not like saying, look, I can look at the petrol gauge and then I can nip round the back and look at the car. It's making a judgment. Of course, we make that judgment in light of what happened in Iraq. And what happened in Iraq was there were no weapons of mass destruction found. But we're not escaping the burden of judgment as we make that claim. And the POMOs and the skeptics are going to jump in and say, hey, and that judgment is, and then they're going to tell their litany of forces, dark forces and culture and all the rest.
Right, right.
So
Dan in Daly City's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dan.
Yeah, hi. I I had a question about correspondence and non-correspondence, sort of like dissonance, and how there's never really pure correspondence because there probably always could be a contrary view. And even beyond that, I don't know if this is human nature or not, but it seems that there are always, and maybe these are dark forces, but maybe it seems that there are always people who, and I don't think I'm paranoid, will try to twist the facts or spin the subjectivity so that to disprove or to dissuade someone. And how do you know when you hear different sources which one to believe? And also, do you think it's possible that history and the present are replete with this, that there are people out there who are dishonest, who will actually try to trick other people and say untruths?
Dan, thanks. We've got the gist of your question. I'm gonna phrase it a little bit slightly differently, Simon. Look. All kinds of things, it goes back to the Pomo things, all kinds of things push and pull our judgment. How can I tell which of those things that push my judgment this way or that way, you know, are going to track the truth? I mean, these things don't come with a saying, I deliver the truth and nobody else does.
No. Well, listen, I've been playing a bit devil's advocate because I've been trying to make the Pomo position sound intelligible. I am more conservative than you think.
Well, then,
I'm not perhaps quite as conservative as John, but basically the answer to that question lies, I think, partly in experience and partly in judgment, what Aristotle would have called practice or phronesis, a capacity to judge. You've got to learn when to listen to guys and when not to, when to go around with a raised eyebrow. I mean, we English are very cynical about things. So as soon as a politician tells us something, we say, you know, why is this lying bastard lying to me? whereas Americans, I think, are much more accepting.
We're learning.
You're learning. You've got a very good teacher up there in the White House.
It was a painful century, but I think we're getting it. Here's something that I'm sure you can tell us a lot about, Simon. Would any of you, this is by email and it's from Alan, would any of you care to comment on Heidegger's notion of truth? Not something we actively discover, but something which reveals itself to us. So Simon, if you could just kind of distill from your four or five chapters on Heidegger in your book, what you think about that?
Heidegger's a charlatan, and he had a priest's attitude to truth, which is that I know it, the nature of being has been revealed to me. And if you worship me long enough, then it'll be revealed to you too. And he took in a lot of weak-minded people, and that's a great pity, and it's done philosophy a lot of damage, and he should be avoided.
So reading between the lines, you're not a great admirer of Heidegger.
Oh, did I imply that?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can. We're talking with Simon Blackburn about the value of truth. You can join this discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's really true. 415-841-4134. And Dimitri in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dimitri.
Hi, thank you. My question is for Simon. From my understanding, you published a dictionary of philosophy.
That's correct.
And I bought one, actually, when I was being at the University of Sussex. This is my last year at the university, and I was quite suspicious at first of getting a dictionary of philosophy. And since we're talking about truth, I was wondering what sort of reaction did you get from your peers when you wanted to create a dictionary of philosophy and define, you know, philosophical movements, philosophers, philosophical terms, for example, correspondence theory of truth.
Right.
What reaction did you get?
Oh, well, it's a good question. Some thought I was mad. Some thought I was venal. I was looking for the money. Others thought that I'd commit suicide before I was halfway through. I guess it wasn't wholly positive, the reaction from my friends. But I eventually pushed it through, and I'm very pleased to say it's by and large, been very well received. So, you know, it was fun. It was a learning experience. I was conducting my education in public.
Did I forget to tell you that I admired you greatly for doing the dictionary, and I knew you were mostly motivated by doing a service to philosophy?
Yeah, and then your book on lust. What's the title of the book on lust? It's called Lust, right? The Seven Deadly Sins. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the value of truth with Simon Blackburn.
What are the truths that are too dangerous to know? Or is the truth worth believing no matter what the cost? Is it ever rational to believe a comfortable falsehood rather than a discomforting truth?
Discomforting truths, comforting falsehoods, and more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. But first, you'll hear from Holly Kernan about how to keep this lovely station and quality programming like Philosophy Talk on the air.
But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way.
Always true to you in my fashion from Kiss Me Kate. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the value of truth with the noted philosopher Simon Blackburn. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Or you can email us, as a lot of you are doing from all over the world. We're really thrilled to get those emails. Comments at philosophytalk.org, or go to the philosophytalk.org website and just mail by hitting the comments button.
So, Simon, I'm going to give you a little argument that goes back to some of the stuff John and I were talking about at the very top of the show. Not all truths are created equal. Some are trivial or irrelevant and not worth bothering to pursue. Some are dangerous to know or believe. I mean, they just, some people could just be completely debilitated by them. Mm. On the other hand, some falsehoods can be very useful to believe, right? Mm. So what these useful falsehoods and these useful truths have in common is utility, the thing that matters. Believe what's useful to believe. No, truth is accidentally. I mean, some of them will be true and some will be false, but truth per se isn't what really matters to us. What do you think of that little argument?
Well, it's a very difficult argument to combat, and of course it's the premise of the therapy industry. You know, they try and get you to believe that you're popular and that you can improve day by day and all the rest of it. Those things are obviously not true, at least obvious to anyone of the meanest intelligence that they're not true. But by repeating them and kind of getting into a slightly hypnotic state of half believing them, allegedly you can improve your life.
Right.
It's a challenge, and it's very difficult to know how to protect the value of pure, unadulterated, transparent, simple truth.
But let me ask you a question. Wait a minute. So there's the useful falsehoods, but then there's also the useless truths. There's all kinds of trivial stuff. John is a big fan of saying, why don't we waste all this money kind of exploring on the other side of Mars? I mean, it's not going to make any difference to human life, right?
So I agree. I mean, I think the science has been very bad at remembering that they're useless truths, and sending men to Mars is probably a fertile source of them.
It's probably beat sending them to Iraq, but
it beats that. Yeah, I agree.
So you said it's difficult to combat, but you've also said that you're conservative, right? Yeah. Help me combat this argument.
Good. Well, I think the value of truth could be conditional. If you're to form an opinion about X, then it better be the true one, which, of course, leaves it open that you're not going to form an opinion about it. You're just going to pass it by. You're not interested.
Wait a minute, but you just gave me this therapeutic argument. Suppose I have such a psychology that the truth would just debilitate me, and believing certain falsities would uplift me and get me going.
Yeah, what I just said copes with the useless truth, the ones you just passed by. You can still acknowledge that if you're going to form an opinion about the number of pebbles on the beach, then it better be a true opinion.
If anything's going to turn on it, like a bet or something.
Yeah, right, exactly. Otherwise, don't form an opinion. The useful falsehood is very, very hard to cope with. And the usual way of coping with it is just think of it as an outrider, a maverick. The general utility of truth, I think, goes unchallenged. The utility of, for example, believing that X is popular, if and only if X is popular, is generally pretty clear. the difficulty is the value of believing that I am popular and I'm not is the outrider or the maverick. And they're difficult. They're difficult to cope with. I don't think there's a simple answer.
Well, I think that's an interesting strategy. Mm. Excuse me, this outrider. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there is considerable evidence. I think that psychologists tell us that most people think they don't have extremely way off views about their own traits, but they're about 15 to 20% off. In other words, I think I'm about 15%. More important, more widely read, more respected than I am.
John, I think that underestimates.
and people that don't have this trait of overestimating their popularity, their good looks, not greatly, but just by this little bit, tend to be depressed. Now, on the other hand, it's probably useful to be good at judging other people's popularity. So your strategy is, well, we've got this ability to judge other people, to arrive at the truth. And there's a couple of exceptions, you know, that just come along for the ride.
Are you a truth seeker or a truth avoider? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Simon, you were saying.
I mean, it's a bit ugly, the outrider strategy, and I wish I could think of something better to say. But although I've thought about it for a long time, I'm open to ideas still.
You know,
on that one.
I'm not so sure that the belief in the comforting falsehood is an outrider. I mean, I think human beings, maybe not by design, but partly as a consequence of how they're built, are hungry to believe comforting falsehoods rather than discomforting truths. I mean, some truths are rubbed in our faces, right? I mean, sensation, perception rubs the presence of this microphone in front of me in my face. It's hard to deny it.
Right.
But many, many truths are sort of sneaky little guys. They hide, you know, underneath the underbrush and trying to decide what to believe. I don't go necessarily ferreting out what's under the underbrush.
No, right.
I believe what's comforting, what's simple, what's conservative, what's consistent with what I already believe.
Yeah.
You know, so...
The great figure who really took this very seriously was Nietzsche. I talk about him in the middle of my book at some length. I mean, I think he was the first to take the measure of Darwin and think, well, look, it's much better if we're adapted for some kind of beliefs. Just go with those beliefs. I mean, never mind truth. Maybe we're adapted for them in a world in which they're false, but still, if they're adaptations, go with the flow. And he knew that was a problem. So he talked about the ascetic, the self-denying ordinance that makes us deeply uncomfortable with that. And it was a mystery to him where that came from. How could anything oppose adaptation?
Now, since you're on Nietzsche, Anthony, from Rochester, says, I'm wondering if Professor Blackburn could comment on the place of perspectivism in identifying truth, especially the idea put forward by Nietzsche in relation to morality.
Right.
So you got a comment on that?
Okay, yes. Yes, well, I talk about this at some length. I mean, Nietzsche finds it very easy to associate perspective with error and falsehood. And I think he's followed in that by some postmodernists, at least. Of course, the metaphor doesn't actually encourage that. Perspective is a visual metaphor. And, of course, you can have one perspective on the Eiffel Tower, and then you walk around, you get a different one, and then you walk around and get a different one. And your sense of what the Eiffel Tower is a synthesis of all those different perspectives. I think the way perspective came into Nietzsche's thought was as a kind of blinker or a lens that you couldn't escape from. And then, of course, it does feel like a source of error, or a source at least that cuts you off from the truth, so the truth remains forever unknown. In his own writing, there's a lot of... That's not where it ends up. In his own writing, he ends up, at least in Twilight of the Idols, the last book he published, trying to transcend the distinction between truth and appearance. So although for much of his writing he contrasts them, there's this very, you know, it's like Michelangelo coming to Christianity. Yeah. It's sort of, at the end, he desperately tries to get out of the vocabulary he's used for much of his writing. I think it's very moving, actually.
Simon, we have one last caller on the line, Charlie in San Francisco. Sure. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charlie.
Thank you.
You're our last guy. Go.
My question is, I'm about 99% truthful all the time, but I've always wondered how to answer the question when my wife or daughter asks me how she looks in a particular dress. if you'd like to answer that, I'd be happy.
Thanks, Charlie. Simon, you got one last comment to that one? Then we'll have to say goodbye.
I think what you say is, my, that is a dress.
Whoa. I don't know. I don't think you'd get away with that. I don't think she'd like that very much. Charlie, thanks for the call. And Simon, it's been a pleasure having you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you, too.
Our guest has been Simon Blackburn, professor of philosophy from Cambridge University, author of Truth, A Guide, a book you can get by pledging to KLW.
We want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to. We got a lot of email today. Thanks to our emailers from all over the world. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to get to all of them.
Yeah, but thanks for listening online. That's really cool. You can pledge online, too. We'll tell you about that in a little bit. So, John, what did you learn today? Are you still conservative?
I'm still conservative. I go with the correspondence theory, and if it doesn't fit the correspondence theory, to bleep with it. That's that's my view.
Well, I want to believe the correspondence theory of truth, but I do think there is this thing. Truth is really hard. What we call truth is really hard, and what we really saying when we say something is true is that if we play this game of trying to find out with other believers and with the evidence, we'll kind of converge to this. This is the point of convergence. But that may just be a fact about us, not about anything out there independent of us.
My argument against that would be baloney, Ken. When we say that something is true, we mean the facts correspond with what the words mean.
Well, but how do we settle whether anything is true?
Well, that's a different question.
By playing this game and converting. Well, how do we? Sometimes, why do we know there's something independent of our playing this game? That is the facts.
Well, sometimes you don't just play the game. Sometimes there's nobody else around. You just have to go and look. But when it has to do with the past or things that are distant, things that our language gives us this incredible ability to talk about, we do have to play that game. But underneath it all, I think, is correspondence. Well, and I get the last word because we're running out of time.
Yeah, there you go. But, hey, you don't get the last word because on our blog, I'm going to keep going on about this. And you can check out our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. Go check it out.
And, you know, you can also download podcasts of our program from our website. And before we get totally into this pledge break, I want to say to all of you people out there listening over the internet, and we know that we're getting all over the world, we're getting these emails, you can pledge to KALW. Stay on here long enough to find out why. You can help Philosophy Talk no matter where in the world you are.
And to help us tell you how to do that, we're joined by KALW's news director, Holly Kernan.